President Trump calls on all Americans to condemn racism and white supremacy. An expert on civil conflict says U.S. political leaders must be more careful with their rhetoric.
We need this to be the story from now on in order to dampen the level of violence because, you know, now we're at tens, if not hundreds of people dying as a result of these kinds of sentiments.
I'm Marco Werman. Today we hear from an asylum seeker in Mexico. He says Trump's border policies are understandable.
For myself, I think he's doing the best way. He tried to do the best for the United States.
We also have a moving story of a reunion right here in our studio.
Oh, I'm so happy I finally meet you.
That beautiful moment and more today here on The World. America is in grief after two deadly mass shootings over the weekend. People are also grieving in Mexico. Seven of the victims shot and killed at that Walmart in El Paso, Texas, on Saturday were Mexican nationals. President Trump mentioned them in his statement today from the White House.
Today, we also send the condolences of our nation to President Obrador of Mexico and all the people of Mexico for the loss of their citizens in the El Paso shooting. Terrible, terrible thing.
Trump also spoke directly to what appeared to be a motivation in one of the shootings.
The shooter in El Paso posted a manifesto online consumed by racist hate. In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy.
That was his largest denunciation of white nativism and this sort of extremist rhetoric and action. But I don't think it's too late to dampen it, but we need this to be the story from now on in order to dampen the level of violence.
That was Monica Duffy Toft. We'll hear more from her later in the show today. But we begin with the world's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, who covers the U.S.-Mexico border and what she's been hearing.
There's a collective mourning on both sides. I was checking in with people in Juarez and El Paso and also in other ports of the border. And one of the pastors that I met when I was in Ciudad Juarez recently, he runs a migrant shelter in that city. And he said that he was including prayers for people from Mexico and the United States in this weekend's services. Everybody was, you know, in other ways, kind of bracing themselves for something like this. I think just not just along the border, but among Latino communities and people of who are brown in the United States were bracing themselves for something horrible like this to happen. In some ways, it's not surprising with the rhetoric in the country.
You recently got back, Monica, from the Tijuana-San Diego border where you were on assignment. And this week, we're going to be hearing a series of your stories from there called The Waiting Room. What have you been looking at exactly?
Well, I've been looking at how, you know, with the changes in U.S. policy at the border, the reality that thousands of migrants are now waiting in Mexico. You hear people say it, that it's become this big waiting room, you know. And I wanted to go back to Tijuana to see and hear what that's like. How are people managing these prolonged waits? What's it like for somebody who's just arrived to the border to see other people who've been there for nearly a year? I also wanted to see how people were living, you know, the day-to-day living conditions and how people are thinking about what's next. How long can people wait on the Mexico side of the border? What are those daily calculations like?
Right. And despite what we hear about migrant caravans coming from Central America, you found it to be along the border there an increasingly international mix of people, not just Central America.
Absolutely. I mean, it's still largely Central American, people from Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, but also people from Mexico, asylum seekers, people fleeing dangerous parts of Mexico, arriving to the U.S.-Mexico border, in this case, Tijuana, and seeking asylum from their own country and being forced to wait at the border in Mexico. So that is something that's always striking to me. Mexicans being kept in Mexico, wanting to find a safer place to live. It's also a very international, increasing international group of people at the border. There are entire apartment buildings in Tijuana filled with people from Cameroon, from Haiti, from Cuba, from Ethiopia, including the person that we'll hear from next in this first story. His name is Rawan Rahman, and he's from Iraq. A young man from Iraq in Tijuana, and he told me how he made his way to the U.S.-Mexico border, an incredibly long journey, but also one that is not too unusual to find at certain parts of the border.
All right, Monica, thanks for that setup. Let's hear your story.
Rawan Rahman had never done anything like this. For 1 week, he says he trekked through the Darien Gap. It's a stretch of rainforest running from Colombia to Panama. Anyone who's migrated north by land from South America knows about it. It's grueling and dangerous. Rawan took videos for his mom along the way.
5 hours, 6 hours, we are walking.
5, 6 hours of walking each day, he says. In the video, the jungle's so dense, it's like night under the canopy. There are no roads. Rawan, who's 28 years old, is drenched in sweat and is following this swampy path dotted with empty water bottles. But he isn't alone and points to people with him.
And she's from Ethiopia.
Ethiopia.
Ethiopia. They are from Nepal. Half 2 from Cuba. Half 3 from Iraq.
Nepal, Cuba, and the Iraqis. That includes Rawan and his older brother, all headed for the United States. For Rawan, that was just one leg in his 3-month journey north. Many migrants choose to travel by land because there are tighter visa restrictions for air travel. When we met the other day, Rawan had reached the border and was in Tijuana, Mexico.
Hello. How are you? Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Rawan's new here. It's just day 5. He says that he and his brother spent their first 2 nights in Tijuana on the street until they got some money wired from home. Now they're sharing an apartment with 6 other migrants from Yemen.
Yeah, we are 8 people, me, my brother, and 6 from Yemen.
Oh, so you're 8 people staying in there?
Yeah, 8 people.
8 guys in 2 small rooms in a rough part of downtown.
We pay $300. And
divided by 8.
Yeah.
That's about $40 each month. There's one bed that 2 of the men share and some mats rolled up in a corner. There's backpacks and a plastic bottle cut in half, doubling as an ashtray. No furniture, just a fan blasting. We sit in the stairwell, and Rawan tells me that in Iraq, he lived in the Kurdistan region. He was a welder and a political activist protesting corruption. He said that led to constant threats and beatings, but he also had friends in Brazil, in Sao Paulo. They said, get a visa and come here. So he did.
4 years I live in Brazil. I work Uber.
Then his car was stolen, he says. He was robbed at gunpoint.
So I lose all what I have. So all my life be danger in Iraq, in Brazil too.
He says he wants to be somewhere safer.
I say the best place for me is United States.
Even though he doesn't know anyone in the U.S., but it's a decision that put him on that path, through the jungle and through Central America.
Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico.
What was the hardest part of that trip?
Mexico.
Mexico. He says it was police demanding bribes to continue north.
We pay to them money.
He says an officer in Mexico demanded $500 to let him keep migrating. Rawan pushed back and gave him $200. You hear this a lot in Tijuana. And Rawan says he came to Tijuana because someone along the way said, you can get across the border faster here.
Some people, they say, Tijuana more good, more easy, faster, the process.
But the process can be slow. Just a few blocks from here, there's the plaza where some migrants put their name on a list to see a U.S. immigration official and apply for asylum. Thousands are on the list. It moves slowly. Some days, not at all. Rawan says he'll put his name on the list and wait.
Yeah, we have to go because we don't have any way to enter the United States.
That's the only way.
Yeah. For me, yeah, because I listen so many people, they jump or they have people they pay.
What if you have to stay here 2-3 months?
Yeah, we don't have any choice.
He says he doesn't want to jump a fence.
We wait God what's do for us.
Wait for what God has for you.
God help everyone, and we are waiting of God help us.
He also says that he understands why the Trump administration is making it tougher for migrants to enter the United States. Rawan says that everyone should be vetted before entering the country.
For myself, I think he's doing the best way. He tried to do the best for United States. He gotta know who I am. First of all, he gotta know who I am.
For you, he's doing his job.
For me, hard.
For you, it's hard.
Yeah, for me, hard. But first of all, he gotta think about his country, not me.
Then Pirwan had to go. He was heading to pray at a mosque nearby, close to the beach here and the border fence. A bit of peace and comfort with so much uncertainty ahead. For the world, Monica Campbell, Tijuana.
The protests in Hong Kong are not letting up. In fact, they're only getting more intense. They began back in June, but in recent days, there have been more scenes in the Chinese territory of clashes between protesters and police, lots of tear gas, and even some fires. Earlier today, I spoke with the BBC's Danny Vincent while he was on the streets of Hong Kong. From some of the pictures we've been seeing on Twitter, Danny, it makes it look like there's mayhem. Are you sensing that the protesters are getting more aggressive in their tactics as well as authorities pushing back?
That's right. The protesters are definitely getting more aggressive. We're seeing more sophisticated weapons now. Originally, protesters would only take umbrellas to these protests and they'd be relatively defensive. Now these umbrellas are used as a way to attack. We're also seeing protesters smashing bricks and throw at the police. Many protesters seem very comfortable with that level of violence, but other protesters take this violence even further. They're willing to set fires once they've built some barricades to try to hold the police back. So it seems that these group of protesters, they're becoming increasingly battle-hardened and they're becoming more militant.
How much of the city has been caught up in all of this? Is it kind of isolated to one part of the territory and it's kind of business as usual in much of the rest of Hong Kong?
Now, there are many parts of Hong Kong that are not affected by these protest movements, but they have deliberately targeted different areas and they've tried to mobilize people, especially people in the local communities, to come out onto the streets. But what we have seen today is that the protesters called for a general strike. Many industries supported the protesters and decided not to go to work. But they also tried to force a strike for people that hadn't chosen to take part. And they did that by trying to cause traffic jams, trying to block the subway system here. And that, of course, has definitely frustrated a certain section of society who feel that they're perhaps what they're doing is now clearly affecting their day-to-day life. It's affecting their business. It's affecting their opportunities to make money.
So officials in mainland China, Danny, seem to be on the sidelines watching how these protests play out. At what point do they say enough is enough and assert themselves? And what does that look like?
Well, we're definitely in uncharted waters here. A few months ago, the possibility of the People's Liberation Army entering into the streets of Hong Kong and essentially cracking down on this protest movement, that was something which most observers, most journalists would have thought was not really possible in modern China. It's simply not something that the government would have been willing to do. It's very conscious of how it's seen internationally and in many ways keen to portray itself as a modern, harmonious society and country. But things have changed quite rapidly here. China does have the right legally to send in the troops, but at this stage we simply don't know how this will end.
The BBC's Danny Vincent in Hong Kong. Thanks for your time, Danny.
Cool. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Donald Trump spoke to the nation earlier today about the mass shootings in Ohio and in Texas.
The shooter in El Paso posted a manifesto online consumed by racist hate. In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy. These sinister ideologies must be defeated. Hate has no place in America. Hatred warps the mind, ravages the heart, and devours the soul.
Trump called Saturday's attack in El Paso domestic terrorism. It might well be Trump's strongest condemnation of racist violence to date, but it follows several years of this sort of thing.
The U.S. has become a dumping ground. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. You also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
Timber back!
The center-backed chant there at a recent Trump rally directed at Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. It's the kind of rhetoric from the president that many see empowering a white nationalist fringe in this country. We'll avoid quoting the shooter's hateful manifesto, but it does reflect a worldview shared by other young white supremacist extremists from Norway to New Zealand. They believe their national identity is under threat from changing demographics. That's how Monica Duffy Toff sees it. She's a professor at Tufts University and a leading expert on the roots of civil conflict and civil war. Let me start, Monica, with a question you asked in an article early this year. What happens when a country's core national identity no longer matches its demographic reality?
Well, what it does is it leads to quite a bit of anxiety and trepidation among those, some segment of those who were formerly in the majority. They feel as if they're going to lose political and or economic power. And so they sort of, you know, react to what they see as, you know, what they feel as if dramatic changes within their country and what they think should be the makeup of that country. They have an ideal in their head, what they think the country is supposed to look like. In the case of the United States, it's largely white, Christian, and I would go so far as to say Protestant Christian, and also with males in charge. And so we've seen a lot of dramatic changes in the country, and only now are we seeing it reflected much more publicly in the open, and I would say politically as well.
So you would argue that white Christian is America's core national identity? I mean, what about a nation of values?
I wouldn't make that argument. What I would say is there's some segment of the population that believes that that is what the core of the United States narrative, its history, is and has been, forgetting that, of course, the United States has largely been a melting pot since its inception, since the founding of the country.
So you also can put this in context because you've studied over 100 civil conflicts around the globe. What is the worst example of this pattern that you've seen?
Oh, the worst example is probably former Yugoslavia in the early 90s, where you saw a shift, particularly in Kosovo, that led to Serbs within Kosovo feeling as if the Kosovar Albanians had taken over their what they saw as their homeland territory, and leading to, you know, first of all, civil war, and then, of course, to the breakup of former Yugoslavia. But we also saw similar dynamics in the Soviet Union. I would go so far as to say you can tell a pretty basic demographic historical narrative story for the break of the Soviet Union, which is that the Slavic population, particularly the Russian Slavic population, was becoming a minority. And so there was a sense that, okay, we can let the non-Slav parts of the country go, but we want to hang on to this core. And so today, now, Russia is upwards of 82% ethnically Russian. But in the late 1970s, it was going to be a minority as other parts of the Union were growing, having higher birth rates. Another paradigmatic case is Lebanon and the breakup of Lebanon, where you had different parts of the population sort of cooking the books, actually not giving proper census accounts in order to maintain control over the political system. And if you control the political system, to a large extent, you can control a lot of the economics and markets as well.
So in the case of Russia, you mentioned that today it's 82% ethnic Russian. What does that tell us about this kind of pushback?
What it tells you is that if it's allowed to sort of fester, that it can lead to, you know, large-scale violence. It can. It doesn't have to. Or it can lead to, civil war. And so what I've been studying, I'm finishing up a book on this, is looking at these sorts of dynamics about how in the political arena, once this becomes public and gets vocalized like this, what are the dampers? What are the institutional mechanisms for sort of squashing it? And I'm a bit nervous right now in the United States because at the highest levels, you are seeing this sort of antipathy, this sentiment, this hostile sentiment against non-whites in the country. And you know, they're being labeled criminals, and you're using language about them being insects and invading the country. And to me, this is the beginning of, you know, what I have seen in other cases where you may end up having pushback, right, by those populations if they're strong enough, and you can lead to large-scale violence. And already, what you could see, this is it's a slow-moving revolution that's happening. And the question is it going to be violent or not? Are you going to see the majority of whites, and the majority of the country, by the way, let's not even talk about race, that actually supports immigration and can actually get their voice heard and get it put into the political arena, that we have some immigration reform such that we can move away from these levels of hostility. But the concern is, as we know, I know that President Trump today, that was his largest denunciation of white nativism and this sort of extremist rhetoric and action. But I don't think it's too late to dampen it. But we need this to be the story from now on in order to dampen the level of violence. Because, you know, now we're at tens, if not hundreds, of people dying as a result of these kinds of sentiments.
Monica Duffy-Toft, professor of international politics at Tufts University. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Pakistan is reacting with outrage today after India's decision to end the state of Kashmir's special status within India.
Today is the blackest day of Indian democracy.
That's Mehbooba Mufti. She's a former chief minister of the state of Kashmir. India's special status for Kashmir provided some protections and autonomy for India's only majority Muslim territory. In the last 70 years, the territory, disputed between India and Pakistan, has sparked war and conflict between the two countries. The BBC's Asif Farooqi explains the rights given to Kashmiris under the Indian Constitution.
So that was kind of a buffer between India and the state of Kashmir, which has now been taken away. Now India can directly rule Kashmir.
But the Indian government has argued that the arrangement stunted Kashmir's development and its integration within the rest of India. Just prior to the decree today, the Indian government started a security crackdown.
Telephone lines are down since last night. Internet is not working. There's no way of communicating with the people in Jammu and Kashmir. It's kind of a situation which is very, very alarming.
The Indian government says that's been done to preempt any violence. Pakistan, of course, has a very different take on the contested territory. It has long insisted that Kashmir is internationally disputed and that India alone cannot decide to change its status. The Pakistani government is also saying it will exercise all options to counter the move. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for restraint from all parties. You're listening to The World. Two distant cousins meet for the first time generations after the slave trade tore their family apart.
Somebody who was born in Africa, and just being connected to that person means a lot. You share a common ancestor who was taken to the America 400 years ago.
Their story is still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. You learn something new every day in journalism, but sometimes this job also allows me to witness some extraordinary uplifting moments. Thank goodness for that, these days especially. This moment happened on Friday.
Oh, I'm so happy I finally meet you.
I watched a reunion of sorts. Two sides of the same family. They didn't know one another well, but they were thrilled to confirm their connection, a connection that has survived one of the most shameful eras in America's past. Our story starts with Jean Kapenda, who grew up in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. He teaches criminal justice at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. He's long been interested in genealogy and had given a DNA sample to a genetic testing site and found out he had hundreds of relatives in the Americas, cousins who are the ancestors of people enslaved and taken across the Atlantic in chains. Kapenda arranged to meet three generations of those cousins here in our studio. I asked him what he was thinking about before the rendezvous with Boston-based business student Ayanna Lakes, her mother, and her son.
I was just dreaming that someday I could help African-Americans find their African roots. So I didn't know how I would do it. It's a dream that is about to come true.
You're about to meet one of your long-lost cousins right now. Last night when you were in bed, I'm assuming lying awake, wondering about this moment. What were you thinking?
It's as if I was lost and somebody found me. Yeah.
I think they're coming in now through that door.
Hi! Diana!
So, can I just have all of you introduce yourselves, please?
Hi, I'm Audrey Spencer.
please.
Hi, I'm Ayanna Lakes.
Hi, I'm Carrion Lakes.
So, Ayanna, this is really a special moment. What do you think? What are you feeling right now?
I'm really excited. I'm excited.
What were you thinking last night as you were lying in bed? Could you get to sleep?
Not really.
Really?
I was like, oh my goodness, what are we going to talk about? Am I going to recognize him when I see him? But you look just like your picture.
And Jean, what about you?
This is my Alex Haley moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do your daughters know that we're meeting today?
Yeah, they know.
That's awesome. That's great. I was just excited, too, for you to meet my son, because growing up in Boston, we don't really have a connection to really anything.
Now, the most important thing for African Americans is to connect with an African.
Why did you do the test, Ayanna?
It came from a conversation that I had been having with my cousins and a couple of friends, just trying to find a way to connect with more African Americans and it not be a situation where it's, well, you're Haitian American, you're Jamaican American, you're this American. And for me, it was, well, what type of American am I? And why do I have to identify as one type of American? Because I don't really know where I'm from. If you ask me, I'm from Boston because I don't have another language. We have our own traditions that we've kind of made for ourselves, but I can't say, oh, my family's from Puerto Rico, my family's from Cuba. I can't say that. And that's why it was so great when my cousin reached out.
So it's interesting. Here we are with the innovation of all these DNA genetic testing companies, as well as the coincidence of the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first enslaved Africans in the Americas. So I'm wondering, where do you see this kind of path of discovery taking you?
Hopefully, I'll be able to visit Africa, because I know you said your parents are still there. That was my ultimate goal, is to find a way to get back to Africa. But when I first started it, I didn't know that I would have actual family there. So now it's time to start saving up the pennies, because I really want my son to know where he's from and to not feeling like he doesn't have a connection to his ancestries or to his roots or anything. Because when you grow up and people are consistently asking you, what are you? You know, it kind of weighs on you.
Mm. You've got Tarion, your 8-year-old son, on your lap. Tarion, what would you like to be kind of aware of and understanding when you get older? I mean, what do you want to know?
No idea.
What do you want to know about your ancestors?
I'm just freaking out.
Don't freak out. Ayanna, tell me what you'd like him to know about his ancestors. I mean, you're kind of like getting this fire hose of information suddenly with this meeting with Jean after your DNA test. What would you like him to know, say, 10 years from now?
I would like him to know that no matter what anybody tells him as a Black man, that he comes from strength. And that's one of the main things that I've learned talking to Jean. And I want my son to understand that everything that he has now, somebody had to fight for that for him. And we've had these conversations. Mm-hmm. We have them a lot, especially now with him going into the third grade. I really want him to not have to guess and wonder what he comes from. So when he gets to be in middle school or high school, when someone says, you know, well, what are you or where are you from? You don't look like you're this or that. He can actually give them a good explanation and say, you know, all African Americans don't look the same.
Jean, you said that the most important thing is for African Americans to meet an African. Why?
Why? Because it's been 400 years. Just being connected to that person means a lot. That you share a common ancestor who was taken to the America 400 years ago, 300 years ago, maybe 250 years ago.
And you share a lot of pain, a painful history.
Yes, I do. Human cargo were taken from Africa to the Americas, and African riches have been taken from Africa because of those corrupt leaders who cannot think about the welfare of their people. So they just participate in the exploitation of African resources and putting human beings in conditions of misery. So now my little cousin, my little Tarion. Nephew, Tarion, has an uncle. I am your uncle, and I'm a Lunda from the Congo.
Audrey Spencer, you're Ayanna's mom. What have you been thinking as you've heard this conversation between your daughter and Jean Kapenda?
I'm just overwhelmed. As me being an older African American, I feel good to know now that my grandson will be able to actually say a tribe. That means me too, okay? I am connected to it. And I can actually say, no, I am from
Lunda tribe.
Lunda tribe, where I have been told so many times, you have no country. And that would irritate me to my core. And now we're going to make a number one goal to go over and hug and thank our ancestors that are still in Africa for giving us some pride where we can actually say who we are and what we are about.
What do you do with this? Where do you go with this? Ayana?
I just want to continue to build on it. Our history doesn't begin and end with slavery. Our first conversations had nothing to do with slavery. It had everything to do with your tribe is full of strength and riches. And slavery was just a blip in the radar. And I wish that we as African Americans and, you know, scholars would teach more of the power of the power that comes out of Africa versus just the slave trade. Because it bothers me when February comes around and my son is only learning about three African Americans.
Black History Month.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's it. And he doesn't know really anything else about Black history. So it's up to me to teach him. But now I can teach him Black history and I can also teach him his Black mm-hmm. history. And I can teach him more than, you know, well, we came over and we were slaves and then we had Jim Crow and, you know, now it's this. It's like, no, like we had kings, we had queens, we had riches. You know, our land is still a beautiful place to be. So this is just the beginning for me.
And Jean Kapenda, where does this path take you?
What history has separated, science is reuniting through DNA. And I think they're helping us be one again to say exactly, you're from this place. Mm. Meeting face to face with my DNA cousins is just a blessing, I would say.
Jean Kapenda, Ayana Lakes, Tarian Lakes, and Audrey Spencer, thank you very much, sincerely, for sharing this moment with us. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
Thank you for having us, yeah.
Three generations of Boston residents, Ayana Lakes, her mother and son, met in our studio for the first time with their Congolese cousin, Professor Jean Kapenda. Check out video and some photos of the moment at theworld.org. The U.S. is looking outside of its borders for drugs, prescription drugs. The Trump White House recently said it would allow Americans to import cheaper medicines, especially from Canada. Democratic presidential candidates have also been eager to jump in on this. But in Canada, people are worried that this new demand might leave them with a drug shortage. The World's Ilana Gordon has a story.
Quinn Nystrom lives in central Minnesota. A few months ago, she responded to a post on Facebook and decided to try something she'd never done before, join a caravan to Canada.
So it literally was like two cars. There were six of us. You know what I mean? It was very casual.
The reason for this five-hour trip was to buy insulin from a pharmacy across the border in Fort Frances, Ontario. Nystrom has type 1 diabetes. She depends on round-the-clock insulin to survive. But in the last few years, the price, even with health insurance, has gone up a lot. So she thought, hey, why not go north?
When you're sort of a middle to low income person, you have rent to pay. What that means is you're putting things on a credit card and going into debt.
She says a vial of insulin that lasts her 2 weeks costs her $350 in the U.S.
It costs me $30 in Canada.
The U.S. government has historically discouraged people from importing drugs. For some medications, it can even be illegal, at least technically. Nystrom says she was nervous returning with a three-month supply of insulin, but she says U.S. border agents didn't care. Since then, she's led two more trips north with other diabetes patients. On their most recent visit to a pharmacy in Windsor, Ontario, A well-known U.S. politician joined them.
What are the prices that you pay for the same?
It's the same because it's a type 1 because our pancreas has...
Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, plus a big trail of reporters and cameras.
There are millions of people who are doing exactly what we are doing here today. They're either going to the internet, they're going to Canada, they're going to Mexico, they're going to Europe to buy exactly the same medicine at a fraction of the price.
Sanders is very familiar with the Visit Canada drill. He started medical caravans from his home state, Vermont, back in 1999. Sanders used the opportunity this time to stress that Canada has controls on pharmaceuticals that drive down prices, ones that also drive up, literally, the Quinn Nystroms to Canada to buy them. But these latest trips have struck a nerve. Nystrom has gotten slammed by Canadians on social media for taking their medications.
The biggest criticism is they believe that we are going to create a shortage.
Shortages are already an issue, even at the very pharmacy that Nystrom and Sanders visited.
Thank you for calling the Old Walkerville Pharmacy.
The Old Walkerville Pharmacy.
Please press 1.
Hello?
Hi, is this John?
Hi, good morning. Yes, it is.
Pharmacist John Gerges was ringing people up at the register that day.
Like, it was good because, you know, they were very, happy and grateful.
Was insulin an issue for you to provide to people that you wouldn't normally expect coming into your pharmacy?
No. We do have our own issues with drug shortages, but insulin so far has not been one of them.
Gerges and others say insulin's not actually under threat of running out. It's a very basic drug. But he does worry because other medicines are getting scarce.
Blood pressure medication, some diabetes medication, those have gone missing.
In Canada, pharmacies get their drugs through a central ordering system. But lately, some drugs have become unavailable. Shortages aren't unique to Canada, but hospitals and patients across the country are nervous that a growing U.S. appetite for their drugs could make things worse. Joelle Walker is with the Canadian Pharmacist Association.
One of our biggest concerns is with exacerbating drug shortages in Canada and not being able to respond to the demands of both Canadian patients as well as American patients.
A total of 15 hospital, patient, and pharmacy groups have issued a letter urging the Canadian government to protect their drug supply. Here's the reason. 4 U.S. states have passed measures that would make it a lot easier to import drugs wholesale from Canada and to order them online. And last week, the White House announced plans to make doing just that easier. Andrew Hill is a pharmacology fellow at Liverpool University in the UK. He says any unexpected surge in demand can put a strain on manufacturers.
So you can get drug shortages sometimes because a health authority doesn't order the right amount and suddenly it wants a lot more drug.
The pharmaceutical industry is totally against price controls. They say it's a disincentive to developing new therapies. And some companies have simply stopped making some inexpensive drugs that have been around for decades. But Hill is wary of the idea that lower drug prices could create shortages.
You look at the systems in the United Kingdom and across Europe, where drug prices are 4 times lower than the United States, but we're still able to produce and supply those drugs very reliably.
Canada's population is about the size of California's. It only makes up 2% of the global drug market. So it's this potential mass exportation of drugs from Canada that some health advocates really fear. It's not the caravans of patients making the occasional trip across the border. Quinn Nystrom, the Minnesotan with diabetes who leads some of these trips, can attest.
On our second trip, we had a free 55-passenger bus going from Minneapolis all the way to London, Ontario, okay? We had 15 people on that bus.
They couldn't fill the seats. She says people aren't flooding to Canada, even with a free ride, because for many who can't afford the high cost of drugs in the U.S., they also can't afford taking off work to make the trips. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
A major music festival in Lebanon has canceled a concert by one of the country's best-known rock bands. Church leaders accused Mashru Leila of blasphemy, triggering an outcry on social media and death threats against the group. The organizers of the music festival said they were canceling the band's performances to prevent bloodshed, but members of the band, whose lead singer is openly gay, believe they're the victims of a vicious smear campaign. Here's the BBC's Beirut correspondent, Martin Patience.
They're Lebanon's biggest rock band with fans across the world. Mashrou Leila's lead singer is a Muslim and openly gay. He sings about religion, politics and sexuality, all hugely sensitive topics in the Middle East. We're here outside the gates of the American University of Beirut. It's a glorious campus overlooking the Mediterranean Sea. And it was here a decade ago that the band was formed. So what do people here make of the decision to cancel the concert?
Lebanon is not a country where freedom of speech is protected. And it's a country where no one can protect any person who is threatened or terrorized by some group.
I think everyone should respect what others think about the issue. So if they're in a place that they don't accept this thing, I think that being more respectful is canceling the concert.
I think they are just kids that want to say their opinion. I think it's not more than that. They are making it bigger than it should be, just for political reason, maybe.
Lebanon has always prided itself on being freer than the rest of the Arab world. But church leaders here said Mashrou Leila's lyrics violated religious values. The band says they were subjected to a smear campaign relying on fabrications that couldn't be further from the truth.
For us, we are the last barracks of Christians in the Middle East. We cannot really allow such things to happen.
Naji Hayek is a political activist who was involved in the social media campaign against the band.
Christians 100% feel under assault in this country and see the popular reaction about it. Look at what happened to us in all the neighboring countries. Christians have been kicked out of Iraq. They have been slaughtered in Syria, specifically because they were Christians.
People would be surprised to hear that Lebanese Christians are under siege. It's not as if you're being attacked in the street.
Well, there are different kinds of attack.
If they had blasphemed, as you said, why don't you trust the courts?
Because when you go to the court and you say blaspheme the country, the regular court does not want to raise a big flag about this thing, so they let them go. And we do not want them to go to jail, and we do not want to hurt them or to do anything like this.
But surely if they have blasphemed Jesus Christ, then they should be punished.
Well, there is a different view in Christianity about this. Jesus Christ allows you to blaspheme. It doesn't mean anything. But at the same time, touching our political identity, political Christian identity, has to be defended, and this is the way we defended it.
That's the heart of the matter.
That's the heart of it, yes, exactly.
Lebanon may have been rebuilt after its devastating civil war ended 30 years ago, but the country's sectarian divisions are never far from the surface, and they're often exploited.
If you try people in the street, that means that you are no more a state. I'm Nizar Sarie. I am a lawyer and executive director of the Legal Agenda. That is now everybody imposing his own law and his own rules. And that's what is what's scaring in this issue, that there are people who are trying to impose what they believe as right. It's mob justice. So that is what is really particular in this issue. There were many other artists in the Lebanese history who were sued or prosecuted for blasphemy. But this time, I mean, it reached a very, very high level and the state was totally silent.
This was always about far more than just a band. It's about how Lebanon views itself as a country. In many ways, it's similar to what we're seeing elsewhere in the world. But the danger here is that sectarianism can very quickly lead to violence.
The BBC's Martin Patience-Air reporting from Beirut. Before we call it a show, here's one final story for you. It's about never giving up. Enter Frankie Zapata, a French inventor. He built a jet-powered hoverboard. It is what it sounds like, a floating skateboard made famous by this guy.
Hey, stop! Little girl, stop! Look, I need to borrow your hoverboard.
Where is he?
That was Marty McFly, played, of course, by Michael J. Fox, commandeering a hoverboard in the Back to the Future franchise. Hoverboards have been a real thing for a few years now, and Frankie Zapata flew to fame on one last month. Zapata is a former French military reservist. He thrilled the crowds in Paris on Bastille Day as he flew above the grandstands on his hoverboard during a military parade. And yesterday, he wowed the crowds again as he flew his one-person flying pad across the channel from France to England. Here's Zapata just after landing safely in Britain's St. Margaret's Bay.
I'm feeling happy. I'm feeling lucky. And yes, it's just an amazing moment for me. I'm so proud for my, and so happy for my family and my friends and my team. You know, everything was behind me, pushing me every day since now 6 months. So yes, it's an amazing moment in my life.
Zapata started working on his hoverboard 3 years ago. He got a grant of nearly $1.5 million from the French Army in late 2018 to help finance what he calls a flyboard. His flight across the channel meant landing on a boat halfway across and refueling while flanked by three helicopters. Quite the operation. This was his second attempt crossing the channel on a flyboard. In a failed effort last month, Zapata was knocked off balance while attempting refueling on a boat. But he fell. This time he used a bigger boat and a bigger landing platform. From start to finish, the journey took Zapata only 20 minutes. Try doing that, Marty McFly.
Are you telling me you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Yeah, no one said it'd be easy. That is our show today. I'm Marco Werman. The world's theme music was composed by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. See you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.